Right, anybody got any questions?
You'll have to speak up, because I'm afraid, even with hearing aid now, I sort of...
I haven't got a question at the moment. I can only say how much I enjoyed your talk.
Oh, good.
To bring those the different strands together, and we're, our concern is with moving forward. We don't have to look very far these days to see that something's gone wrong with how human beings are organised their social organisation.
Yeah.
The recognition that we are all the same, but unique as individuals.
Yeah.
I just thoroughly enjoyed it, and ready to go and start working again.
I pointed out this little book here, which you actually produced a decade ago. And it's all about the kind of, when sociobiology, which is now, it's really been very well supported, the sociobiology and evolutionary psychology and all that sort of stuff, actually. But this is a critique of the early ones, people like Audre and people like that were saying, there was a naked ape and Audre was suggesting, I'm humans by nature, are killer apes, We like baboons and we like, like gorillas, except human beings go around killing each other. That's what things. And there's a book that's recently come out called Straw Dogs by John Gray, who is one of these academics who produces a book every year, bestseller. And he's a good writer, and he's a professor of... professor of politics at the LSE, and he wrote his book Straw Dogs, and he more or less describes humans as homo rapiens. They go around sort of smashing the environment and damaging everything, best thing get rid of them, because they're so awful, and it's as I say, it likens back to the original sin idea, by nature we're kind of, we've fallen. And there's no evidence for it at all. When you look at societies, and again, going to Engels, because Engels was very critical of Darwin. Although at one level, Engels was very keen on Darwin, really was very, very keen on Darwin. At another level, he said, this Malthusian kind of Hobbesian thing, we're all in competition and war against war sort of thing. For goodness sake, that's only part of humans. The struggle, there's this other part, which is cooperation and things, Seeing everything as a struggle for existence, and it's not a way to see humans.
Well, I'm looking around the room, and I can see that most of us here have been around the block a bit, and none of us bring it. And extrapolating from my experience, and I've started off in the building trade, working and living on buildings like South Station, Steel Mills, that sort of thing. I've been around the world a couple of times, camped all over Europe, and in my experience, the overwhelming majority of all the people I've encountered through my life would rather see me happy than miserable, would rather see me housed and homeless, do me a favour and dump on me, tell me the truth, tell me a lie. So from my experience, straight back from that, the vast majority of people on the planet are decent. Mm. Well, when I first joined, I'm quite full of experience, full of enthusiasm, and I got myself up to Speaker's Corner. And I must have known about 10 years, every Sunday during the summer when it wasn't raining. And I've spent most of my time defending the counter and the slanders that I was getting from the people I was talking to about human beings. Our problem in society today is that we are not who we've been told we are.
Mm.
We've been conditioned to think, all this stuff, about life is violent, short, and brutal, whatever, that stuff has to be conditioned into us so that we accept society as it is, because society is vastly nasty, greedy and avaricious. So that's part of our conditioning. And you mentioned Homo sapiens. So what's really important about your talk, what I enjoyed about it, is that you said I'll get to it, is that you mentioned Homo sapiens. Well, sapien comes from the Latin superior, to be wise.
Mm.
And surely the base of all real wisdom, the foundation of all real wisdom, must be self-knowledge.
Yeah.
Within you've got a fair idea what to do with your knowledge. And as societies are all social relationships, then the more we know about what we're relating with and who we're relating to, the more function, the more functional and more human that society will be. And I've got this point, our natural relationship, we talk about our biology, our natural biological relationship with one another, which is important, which gives us our first guidance, is one that, as we all share the same ancestors, the paleoarchaeology and genetics told us that this female human about 120,000 years ago called mitochondrial Eve, we all relate to her. And there's a chromosomal Adam fella about 60,000 years ago, we can all be traced back to it. So therefore, we are a family. It's not just a species, we're not homogeneous, we are a family. So if we're to be true to ourselves as members of a human family, if we're to acknowledge that, then what we have to do, we have to bring according to our ability and take according to our needs. Because that's the ethic that allows a family, a modern family, the nuclear family, to function as it should. You're right. Knowing who we are, the more we know about what it is to be human, the more human we can be. Because we never ever get any kind of any decent lessons on what it is to be human. We might get some bit of philosophy here and there, but we just don't get it in depth. Because we're not supposed to. We're supposed to be. We're conditioned. We're socially conditioned to be servants. We're socially conditioned to be servile. So that's what we have to overcome.
I think that distinction you started with, actually, you made a kind of distinction between knowledge and wisdom. Starting there. It's just not knowing things, but actually how one utilizes knowledge to think. And it's a good distinction to make. Actually, it's an old distinction, to go back to the Greeks. But it's not just that we learn for knowledge, but we use knowledge in order to, make the world a better place and to think like that.
That's right.
But Marx always made that distinction, really, of social in itself of being, separate from capitalism and don't forget, capitalism would fall to the ground if actually weren't people cooperative in the social. The whole system depends on the fact that people are kind to each other, cooperate with each other, trust each other. No, that's the kind of oil that keeps the damn thing going, really.
It's like women drivers. The thing is, you see a guy do something silly on the road, you just drive and be silly. If you see a woman doing it, it's not so bad now. Far more women on the road. If you saw a woman in those days, or if you saw a woman, it was because it was women drivers. It's the same thing. You see humans behaving badly, and that's humans for you. We all get. And it's like the us and them. This was explained to me once. It's very written. Is that us are all the people we know and like, and them are all the people we don't like and don't know. It's our view about our fellow humans. If you go somewhere where you don't speak the language, the best thing you can do is learn the words for please and thank you. Be prepared to smile. And it's got me out of trouble loads of times.
people are
helpful and honest.
Of course, traditionally we've drawn a distinction between human nature and human behaviour. Human nature is biological. Human behaviour is social.
Well, there's the equation, isn't there? You take human nature, you add situation, and what you get is human behaviour.
We have recently come out of feudalism, and therefore we are making feudalism depend not in this country, less in this country, but more in countries that are judged. Most of the time people don't work in feudalism. They are, it is either very cold or very, very hot. In cold weather they are at home and don't work. Therefore we need we have created a system to force each other to work hard. And on the other hand, some of us, in fact, capitalism is made of compulsory labor. If compulsory labor doesn't exist, we don't need the capitalism. And on the other hand, some people want more than they deserve. Mm. I think these are the two main reasons that capitalism exists.
Yeah.
Compulsory labor and greed.
Yes, could we go back to the very beginning of your talk, and you mentioned Thomas Hobbes,
yeah,
who's arguably the most influential philosopher that Europe produced in the Enlightenment. He was right at the very beginning of the Enlightenment, and when you read the opening chapters of Leviathan, you encapsulate there all the arguments socialists come across about human behaviour. You know, human beings are greedy and always wanting more, and so on and so forth. And I'm wondering, was Hobbes on his own in this? I mean, how much of his thinking was original? Were there any precursors, and were there any who were using the same kinds of arguments in non-European societies, you know, like India, China, places like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, really. At one level, Hobbes is seen as quite unusual in the sense that he argued for a political system without reference whatsoever to spirits, God, and the religious things. So he was seen as a naturalist at one level, a materialist. I mean, he was a materialist at that, but it was a very mechanical kind of materialist, you know. I think there are traditions in China that may be seen as similar, you know. But most traditions, like Hindu traditions and things like that, they're kind of religious or quasi-religious traditions. And I think what was important to him, as why you sort of link him to the Enlightenment, he was breaking away from the religious traditions. He was trying to argue for, basically the kingdom, the crown, the sovereignty, having full sovereignty kind of thing to coerce people. But from a naturalistic point of view, he wasn't referring to the gods. He was, in a sense, he was against the idea of the divine rule of kings, really. They don't have that divinity. And he was trying to find arguments for it, really. You know, but it's very... So he's the beginning. But to what degree, I don't know. There probably were precursors. You know, the people before him were similar. But he is seen as kind of unique at that particular time, sort of the 16th century. And it's the beginning of, you know, Copernicus as well, and you know, seeing the world in a very different way. Lots of things were happening in that sort of 1600s type, you know, 1500s, 1600s before the Enlightenment. So I can't really answer your question, but there may be in other traditions, but... He just come out to the, you know.
It certainly seems that.
I mean,
his ideas certainly seem to have permeated everywhere. I mean, we've come across, when we're trying to propagate the idea of socialism, it doesn't matter where the objection comes from, whether they live in California or whether they live in Kenya. Or the same objections.
Yeah.
Are raised, and they all seem to run back to Hobbes, who, you know, in his writing, you can tell how insecure he is living in this society that's tearing itself apart.
Yeah.
And there's a new class coming to the fore.
Yeah.
Who wants to do away with absolute monarchy and wants to have some kind of constitution where the rule of law. And the argument is, we've got to have this because as human beings, we'd not survive otherwise.
Yeah. I haven't read it for donkey's years, but I know when I first read it, there's that book by Macpherson, who was a Canadian chap, and it was on the theory of possessive individualism, and he uses Hobbes and Locke and all that to the beginnings of this possessive individualism, which is, you know... Which is reflected in Thatcher. When you listen to Thatcher, a lot of things Thatcher said, very, you know, there's no such thing as society, and, you know, we're greedy and all that sort of stuff by nature. And there was that famous time when she came to address the Scottish clerk for people of Church of Scotland, and she tried to say, oh, you know, unlike what Christians say, actually, we're not nice and kind at all. Something can upset all these clergy in Scotland, you know, kind of, you know, took the Christian message is, you know, is to help each other kind of thing, you know. So, the greed was good, you know, nothing, something like that, she said, there's nothing wrong with being greedy or something. So.
If there's a kind of contradiction there, is that, you know, we're told we're bad, that we are urged to vote for politicians who will make us good.
Yeah.
I mean, that book you just mentioned by C.B. McPherson, The Theory of Possessive Individualism, socialists should read it, because it's quite good.
Yeah, I remember reading it years ago, and we're quite impressed with it, you know, the sort of...
I mean, possessive individualism is the theoretical justification for capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, people want to possess what they created as individuals, and so on, and it's all linked up, of course. It was the dawn of capitalism, this was the ideology of capitalism. I always buy a second-hand copy because I see it in the shop.
Yeah. I think basically it's similar to what you were saying, because I think basically what he argues in that book, what Hobbes is actually describing is not people in the state of nature. Actually, what he's describing is his own society and, you know, the beginning of capitalism and you know, that's what he's... And, you know. I think also what you've got to remember about him, a lot of people that, although he, Leviathan and the king had absolute power, a bit like Islam in a way... If the king didn't do what he was supposed to do, you were fully justified in getting rid of him. So there was a kind of clause to it, you know. A bit like Muslims, you have the ruler, but if the ruler doesn't rule properly, and you know, you're fully entitled to sort of get rid of them, you know, sort of assassinate them, you know. And I think about the first three rulers of Islam were all assassinated, you know.
There's another pamphlet. You mentioned this pamphlet. There's another one there, Marxism and Darwinism, by Anton Panikat, which is written, what, over 100 years
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, that's
over
right.
Over 100
yeah.
years ago, which is quite cool.
Just mentioned how Thatcher embraced aggressive individualism and said people are basically selfish. She wasn't just engaging in an intellectual argument. She was actually part of an ideological onslaught against trade unionism. She's in the context of Tammany, she's trying to share the power of the mandate of from the capitalist class really to try to break up the power of the unions of seeing as too powerful in Britain in the 70s.
Yeah.
And she wanted to take on, especially the miners' union, she wanted to take on to defeat them. So she pushed outside, it was always within society, we're all greedy, we're all selfish. She's trying to promote individualism against the idea of the collective and against trade unions. So it's, you'll see that contest, which is political projects at work to defeat the unions and bring in, to shift the power away from organised labour towards capitalist class.
Mm.
So try to get support on that basis.
Yeah.
We also get back, you mentioned how Thomas Hobbes mentioned that the human life is nasty, pushes short. When you show that time, you describe the life of many people at that time, 62nd, was life of the peasants
separate.
That's probably why it's sort of pessimistic human nature, because the last life of it would reflect yourself in your behaviour. People have a very rough manner about them.
Mm.
Find a very pessimistic sort of view.
Mm. Mm. But this, the main stress in the book, really, and this is why, you know, somebody like MacPherson McChrystal, and talk about the physical individualism, it's actually the really beginnings of individualism in a sense, that human beings, you know, socially they're against competitive whatnot, but the basic they're only individuals, they're non-social, you know. There's this idea that human beings are not social, you know, which is all part of the ideology. But for him, of course, it was seen as you need the government. This is why you need government. You need the Leviathan, because people, you know, not social. You know, what going back to, you know, linking up with Thatcher things, what Thatcher wants to do was get rid of all the social, basically. Her idea of a society was the individual, the family, capitalism, and government. And government supports, you know, she wanted, that's why she was keen to get rid of all the council houses, trying to individualise everything, you know. It was an ideology of individualism, basically. And that's very clear in Hobbes. You know, we're human beings, we have certain drives, and that's it. We're not got what you were saying, and one of the main things about Hume is actually we've got this social, you know, this kind of feeling for other people, basically, the social. So that's why, and you've got the same in Locke, but not such not so sort of thing. It's very much more explicit in Hobbes's Elysium. You know, it's very, very much. It's the beginning of liberalism and individualism as an ideology, which is from there. And you're right, Tom.
I mean, you know, Danny's right. I've spoken in Hyde Park as well, but before Danny, but not quite as long. And the objections you get, this is in the popular mind, if you will.
Yeah.
The question you get, what about the lazy man? What about the greedy man? What about human aggression? All these are questions that get thrown at you if you advocate a socialist society. Yeah. But I mean, they're behind the times. I mean, they date back from all these things. And of course, original sin is part of it as well, I think, because people are taught that they're fallen and evil.
Well, it's capitalism, doesn't it? Because the last thing capitalism needs of a working class is a working class that's full of self-esteem. You know, we can't think, I mean, we have to be robbed of our self-esteem to be servants. The fact that we're here, our socialists are here, because we have got self-esteem. We have no ideals that we are and what we're worth. You know, we're not prepared to live our lives for other people. We're putting up a bit of a fight. You know, and because we have self-esteem, we can see our fellows, and we've estimated their worth because they're the same as us. You know, we want to live amongst free people. It's not just for ourselves. It's for ourselves because we want to live amongst free people.
I think religion is probably, you know, like you said, more to keep people down in a feudal society, whereas this theory of possessive individualism is a justification for capitalism.
I think you have to realise as well that to be social actually is to have certain constraints on you, but it's not coercive and whatnot. I mean, we all come here socially, things like that. No, but nobody forces you to come here. And you all come here and we're all speaking in English. Okay? And we're in a sense, we're constrained to do that, but we do it because we're social creatures. And we realise if we want to talk to each other, we have to use a common language, and which we've implicitly decided we're going to speak English and not Chichewa. You know, and things like that. So this, I'm saying this because I got a lot of anarchist friends who kind of not only anti-state, they're anti-social. You know, they're against the whole idea of being social because they feel that kind of restricts my individuality. You know, who I am and all that. And we are social beings. We are like you said, Danny. We are intrinsically social beings. So we don't even think about it. We come here, we talk English, you know. In a sense, we're constrained to talk English. In fact, if I start waffling on in Chichewa, you'd actually start using constraints against me. You'd say, oh, Brian, we can't understand what you're talking about, mate, you know? You'd start using constraints on me. So there's certain constraints about being social, but, you know, both people are cooperative and do things together. You don't really need, you know, capitalism to tell you what to do and what to do.
One of the harshest punishments they could give you is they put you in solitary confinement. You know, they deny you sociability.
Yeah.
That's it. I did a trip around Europe on a mountain bike, and I spent about a week where I spoke to the sun. Monkeys couldn't speak the language, and I was on my own. And, you know, I got very, very lonely. When I actually met somebody who spoke English,
could I
stop talking? You know,
really
I could see myself doing it, you know.
I've been denied
company.
Yeah, you're not yourself. Anyway, that's a break. There's a collection thing here to help pay for the rates of the building and stuff. But, you know, while that's going around, there's one thing I'm not sure I agree with you on. You said it's possible to think without language. mean, yeah. How is it possible to think without language?
It is. There's some things you can, just, I can't give you an example. There's a lot of things that you know that you can't express in language at all.
For instance, I mean...
Yeah, I'm trying... I got an onion and I got a potato. Okay, I got an onion and potato and I smell them and I can tell you lot, you know, that is very different than the potato and the onion. That knowledge is not linguistic. And I can't even describe to you what is the difference between these two smells. But I know the difference from... there's a knowledge and there's a thinking that's independent of language. Mind you, I can't express Karl Marx's ideas without using language, but I can... The difference between the smell of an onion and the smell of a potato... Do you see what I mean?
Yes, but you've still got to distinguish between potato... And the onion, and you can do that through language,
don't you?
Somebody else.
Oh, yeah, but I need language to communicate that, but I can't actually tell you the difference.
But surely.
You can't express in language that difference, or at least I can't.
Surely your reflexive, non volitional behaviour doesn't have to be consciously articulated in your mind, but your volitional behaviour has to be. Isn't that the difference? In other words, if I do that, nothing's gone on in my mind. If I'm telling you about it, it has.
Yeah.
Got inner dialogue. I mean, my grandmother was Welsh. Her inner dialogue was Welsh. And before she spoke to me, because I only stood English, she had to translate what she was thinking from the Welsh to the English.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you know what I mean? It was, but something that's reflex is different. But something that is based on your inner dialogue and the expression of that surely has to be language based.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what you were saying, that one of the things, the characteristics of humans, is we've got symbolic language. I mean, that's what one of the things distinguishes us from all other animals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that perhaps it comes down to what is the definition of thinking in the end.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about is feeling or something. But
there is a sense in which you can have the thought and you express it in two different languages. So, if they're not, so in a sense, the thinking and language are distinct.
Well, you must say not.
Yeah.
If
I can communicate the same thought in two different languages.
Yes.
So there must be a distinction between...
Well, I'm not saying they're the same. I'm saying you can't... I think you can't think without a language, whichever one it is. That's just something to think about while the collection was taking place.
Well, I'll be a word for it.
What people get using the same words, but getting a different meaning from them. I mean, other people talk about socialism and don't mean what we mean by socialism, they mean nationalisation and being nice to workers is somehow sort of being socialist, but they're using it a different way. And the other thing is that people seem to talk without thinking. They seem to be using the words without thinking what they're saying. And a member yesterday at a meeting, he repeated what he'd heard someone saying talking about immigrants. Just sort of crude, no thought at all, just sort of accepting I'd shoot them all sort of thing, you know, and really sort of absence of any actual thought about it, any sort of learning of what's happened and you said of history and things that lead to the circumstance, you know. People just sort of reinforcing their easy prejudices, their easy answers to problems. Or, well, if they all went away, you know, everything would be all right. You're having completely forgotten what it was like in an earlier age when there was not. There was always a movement of people, of course, but not to the same extent as there was sort of after sort of 1945, say, and what the circumstances were, the same problems that have gone on, you know, the poverty and the unemployment, and they're all there, but somehow the thoughts don't get sort of through to people. They sort of sort of take, unfortunately not everyone, but sort of far too many people just take this easy, not thinking, but just repeating the words.
Yeah. Actually, that takes us back to the talk last week, when the speaker drew a distinction between thinking and reasoning. And these people are obviously thinking because they're using language, but they're not reasoning validly. Right, thank you for collecting the £24.06. Anybody else want to say anything? We all agreed, didn't we?
Yeah.
Today unions have two ASC, Labour Party, union members. Should they still pay to the Labour Party?
Well, some unions are affiliated with the Labour Party, and unless you opt out of paying the political levy, your union, part of your union contributions will go to the Labour Party.
You mean I can be a member of a union without paying Labour Party?
Yes.
But in the past it was compulsory to pay Labour
It's never been.
The default was paying Labour. The default was paying Labour.
If a trade union is affiliated to the Labour Party, you've got the legal right to opt out of paying to the Labour Party. I mean, that has always been the position. In fact, the Tories want to change that even more now, to say if you're a member of the union and you want to pay to the Labour Party, you've got to opt in to pay. So, I mean, but it's never been the case. Well, it might have been the case before 1908, that you, if you, your union could use your money to against your will to pay to the Labour Party, but.
It's also the case that some unions have a political levy, but they don't necessarily give it to the Labour Party. My union has a political levy, but it spends it on campaigning generally without any affiliation with a particular political party, which is, from our point of view, probably preferable.
Well, when did they cancel the default of paying Labour Party? What was the year?
The year?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's been going
and
since.
This year, the default case was cancelled.
Right from the beginning, I mean.
1908, 1910, something like that.
But I read this revisionist socialist voyage, that the workers had to pay the Labour Party as a default. They just could drop out, but if they didn't drop out, they would automatically pay Labour Party.
Yes, that's the case today. That still exists at the moment, yes.
Okay.
So if you forget to opt out,
you'll be. And how much is that?
Oh, I don't know. How much is it? How much do you hope?
I think it's about £10 a year. It's not a lot.
No. I opted out more than 50 years ago, and it was about fourpence, I think, or it was sixpence, and I opted out and only paid fourpence of it.
It's typically a fraction, isn't it, of the overall subscription? Because I pay, I think it's £14 or £15 a month. So what, that's £170, £180 a year. And I think the political levy is something like, don't quote me, it's something like £10 or £12 a year.
Yeah, but this for a party that has... for a country that has 30 million workers, becomes 300 million pounds a year for the Labour Party.
Well, as I say, my union doesn't actually pay it to the Labour Party, it uses it on general campaigns.
But in the past, they
paid. Yeah, some unions do, yeah.
This is very interesting.
Mostly they. Yeah.
I suppose it has got to do with human nature.
300 million pounds to Labour Party.
But anyway, I'm looking forward to the time when the union members pay their political contribution to the Socialist Party. Anyway, do you want to say anything as yours?
Example of human social
team. Social workers will pay money to the Socialist Party. Anyway, Brian, do you want to sum up or say anything before we disperse and have a cup of tea upstairs? Okay, well, just thank you again for
pleasure.
Some talk and some discussion. Oh, I should mention.